Okay, hi everybody. It's Monday, it's 1 o'clock. And through the wonders of Facebook and the through the sponsorship of the Tel Aviv International Synagogue under the leadership of Rabbi Ariel Constantine, we're back with Pirkei Avot, History and Hashkafa. We have a little bit of both today and I think in the coming weeks. Interestingly, I've always found, no matter what the topic of the class that I'm teaching is, or whatever the case might be, that everything we study, doesn't matter which text, doesn't matter which context, it's always very, very contemporary. And as we'll see today, the Mishnah is the new Mishnah that we're starting is really quite relevant to at least what's going on in Israel, and I think it's not irrelevant to what's going on in the rest of the world as well. We are in chapter 2, Mishnah number 2, and the Mishnah reads as follows. Rabban Gamliel, the son of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, says, it's proper, it's appropriate, it's nice to combine, or they go together, Talmud Torah, the study of Torah, and with Derech Eretz. We're going to come back to that in a minute. She giat shnehem, because when you exert yourself in both, you end up not sinning, or you forget about sinning. And any Torah, any study, which does not is not accompanied by gainful employment, malacha, sofa betela, in the end will become betel, will end up becoming worthless, or end up becoming nulled, and actually inevitably leads to sin. And if you participate in communal affairs, you should actually just participate as an ideal, out of altruistic motives, for the sake of heaven. Because those who actually do are altruists and they do their communal duties for the sake of heaven, the merit of their ancestors sustains them and helps them. Utzdaka omedet la'ad, and tzidkatan, sorry, and their righteousness stands forever. It's a very clumsy formulation. We'll have to look at see what that really means. V'atem male ani alechem shachar harbe kilo asitem, and you, I will contribute to you lots of merit. As if you did. I mean, the second half is really very clumsy. Not clumsy, it's not clear. It's not straightforward. We're going to have to, it won't be today, we'll have to really take a look at this. What I want to concentrate on is the beginning. So first of all, it's something interesting about this Mishnah as it is, and that is that it's attributed to Rabban Gamliel, the son of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Now, Rabban Gamliel, the son of Yehuda Nasi, lived after his father, or he actually inherited his father's position as the head of Sanhedrin, meaning he lived after the Mishnah was redacted, or the Mishnah was promulgated. So he ostensibly doesn't belong in the Mishnah. But there are cases where actually later scholars are mentioned in the Mishnah. And the whoever put the final touches on the Mishnah and added this, I think was trying to make a point of continuity in Jewish leadership. From the time of Hillel, the patriarchate, the head of Jewish government in the land of Israel, self-rule, was in the hands of the house of Hillel. And it's clearly that there was some point that was trying to be made, here in terms of continuity, in terms of legitimacy of inheritance. This is kind of interesting because in principle, Jewish leadership is not hereditary. It's not monarchy is hereditary, but intellectual leadership is not. Even though there's something of a tendency to expect or to hope or to be comfortable with the idea that children will inherit their parents' position. You find this especially among Hasidim. That when it comes to who's going to continue to be the Rebbe after the Rebbe dies, assuming there is going to be one. Yesterday was the 3rd of Tammuz, and we mark the anniversary of the passing of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he didn't have any, he had no children, and he also had nobody that was appointed after him. But in most Hasidic dynasties, they're dynasties. So it's either the son or the son-in-law, whoever the case might be. In any event, I don't want to go I don't want to overemphasize that part of things here. I'm more interested in actually the content of the statement. Yafet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz. The study of Torah goes well with Derech Eretz. Now, what's Derech Eretz? Now, here, strikingly, you have two very divergent paths of interpretation, and both of which serve as, in every generation, serve as a jump-off point for broader debates about very basic issues. So, for example, the first, there are two ways of understanding Derech Eretz are, A, Derech Eretz means proper comportment, acting like a person, etiquette, however you want. That's one possibility. So, in other words, if you are going to, the Talmud Torah, that studying Torah goes well with acting, as my mother would probably say, like a mensch. Act like a person. Don't be arrogant. Comport yourself properly. Inspire inspiration and admiration on the other parts of other people, which we talked about actually in other connections. I'm going to put that aside for a moment. The real issue that comes up here, and it just keeps getting ground, I'm thinking in Hebrew, is the question of, is the assumption, and that seems to be the majority position among, at least how the commentators saw this, that Derech Eretz is a synonym for the word that pops up later, which is Melacha. Derech Eretz means, Tov Torah im Derech Eretz, that if you want to, the best way to do Torah is to study Torah is to be self-sustaining. In other words, make a living. Get a job. In other words, there is an implicit admonition, or maybe an explicit admonition here, that Torah should not be, should not charge for Torah, that a professional rabbinate is not desirable, that the best way for Torah to be sustained is to cultivate a career. Now, the question is, what kind of career? And what is the relationship between both in terms of value and in terms of time expenditure in the relation between Torah study and making a living? So it is clear from the Talmudic texts that most of the rabbis, all the rabbis, made a living something else. Maimonides makes a big deal of this. People did not take money for teaching Torah, there was certainly no established rabbinate as there became later. But whether or not that, as I said, whether or not that was, whatever the historical situation was in the time of the Mishnah, it is certainly clear that from the post-Talmudic era on, the question of whether you should have, or is it legitimate to have professional rabbis and a professional rabbinate, which raises money and gives and sustains scholars taking a budgeted salary from the general public. In some cases, even leveling taxation to be able to support whether it's yeshivot or whether it's individual rabbis. This becomes a hot button issue, which is the truth of the matter is still to this day not fully resolved. Let's start with the question of theory, and then let's go to practice. Yafet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz. So we have two schools. The first school is represented by the Babylonian Gaonic Spanish, even North African school of interpretation. And overwhelmingly, despite the Rambam, and overwhelmingly, their position was Yafet Tov Talmud Torah Derech Eretz, that despite that, there is certainly good reason to enforce or to provide stipends and salaries for rabbis because they serve the community. This became, and this is a long history of an established rabbinate and for subsidized Torah scholars, so they don't have to work. The Gaonim, for example, the Yeshivot in Surupa Medita, it wasn't such a huge a number of people, at least most of the time, their staff, but the Gaon took a salary and all of his, let's call it a court, took salaries from the communities throughout the Muslim Empire. Students received, it seems, some kind of stipend. And even later, once the Geonet lost its grip on the Jewish world, you find a lot of emphasis on rich people giving money to sustain Torah scholars. So, for example, in the 12th century chronicle Sefer Kabbalah of Avraham Ibn Dawud. He writes that when he writes about Shmuel HaNagid, one of the things he praised Shmuel HaNagid for is that he spent a fortune of money not just to provide books for students, but also to support students they don't have to work. Now, how does this, how do you square this? So you have an entire literature that tries to square that phenomenon with this Mishnah, saying, first of all, you can interpret it as Derech Eretz, meaning you should act like a mensch, it's not referring to making a living. On the other hand, you can say to Yafet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz, but if you have to choose between the two, then you really should go with the Talmud Torah because we're not going to shortchange scholars and deprive ourselves of scholars because they can't both make a living and work. It is against this background that the great cri de coeur, the great cry of the heart, the great opposition to giving professional employment to rabbis comes, and that comes from Maimonides. Maimonides was absolutely just emphatic, is even the word, opposed to rabbis taking money. He says it's a desecration of God's name, and it leads to the lowering of standards. And it's a horrible thing, and he himself lived that way. Up until a certain point, he actually invested what little money he had with his brother, and his brother, he was a silent partner in his brother's pearl business. But when his brother drowned in the Indian Ocean, he went off and worked as a doctor, and he did not take a dime for Torah. The truth of the matter is that there is a very profound educational and occupational truth in not giving or not making a rabbi a salaried functionary of the community. And that is the minute that you give somebody money for something, you basically compromise their authority, you compromise their integrity, and you compromise their ability to function. You can't, because the minute you have this conflict between being not just an authority, but also like a father figure and a religious authority and a person to be esteemed and an employee, that doesn't go together. I mean, if children paid parents, for example, for being parents, I mean, you know, where would parental authority go? And not that it's doing so well nowadays, but that's not the point right this minute. In fact, I remember many years ago, I think he thought I was crazy, but all right. I remember telling Dr. Lam, Zeichner Tzadik Levracha, who recently passed away a year ago, that I think that every single graduate of Yeshiva University who gets smicha, who becomes ordained, should actually be, they should, instead of getting an MA in Jewish philosophy or an MA in Jewish history or whatever, they should really get a professional degree so that they'd be able to make a living from whatever they did outside the synagogue. And there in the synagogue they would take expenses, but they would be able to be fully, their authority would not be impugned by virtue of the fact that they're dependent upon the Balibant, upon the congregants. A good example, by the way, of this and how it can work really, really well, actually there's two examples. One was the late Chief Rabbi of Toronto, Rabbi Aaron Price, who was a very wealthy, he's in real estate, I think, Gerach Hasid, but independent, he made his own money. And similarly, Rabbi Bezalel Zsolti, who was the Chief Rabbi of Yerushalayim, in both cases, he was also in real estate, his family was wealthy. In both cases, they were able to make controversial declarations and take strong stands because they said, fire me. Cut my salary. I mean, that's a very empowering moment, and I think that's what the Rambam had in mind. The problem is that such a situation just was not sustainable throughout the Middle Ages. And we see this. We see this not so much among the Sephardim, we see that among Ashkenazim. It is very clear, to me anyways, that up until the 14th century, among Ashkenazi Jews, and here we're talking about Jews in France, Jews to a lesser degree, Jews in England, and Jews in Germany, the rabbis, the scholars did not take money, did not take salaries. They were organized kehilot, but the rabbis did not take salary. They were all in business of one sort or another. To the extent that there is a striking statement that is clearly, it's attributed to Rabbi Jacob Tam, to Rabbeinu Tam, who died in 1171, who was Rabbi Rashi's grandson. By the way, shout, I don't really like that word, but the shout out, a reference to a phenomenal biography of Rabbeinu Tam, which was recently published by my friend Professor Rami Reiner at Ben-Gurion, and my neighbor, who lives in the next hill over, about Rabbeinu Tam. If those of you whose Hebrew is good enough and are interested, I highly recommend it. Because of the sort of haphazard way that the Jewish Hebrew Book Week was organized this year, it was on, it was off. I understand that Bar Ilan University Press does not have a presence at some of these fairs, so you have to buy it online from Bar Ilan University Press. But I highly recommend it. Anyways, Rabbeinu Tam, who was he put his money where his mouth was. He practiced what he preached, and he actually was a business person. Apparently, was a moneylender, which pretty standard for 12th century France. He has an incredible statement, interpretation of this Mishnah. He says, he makes an interesting grammatical point. And this, by the way, apparently attracted so much attention subsequently in the late 12th, 13th, and 14th century that it was quoted, I know of at least three or four places in late medieval Ashkenazic literature where this is quoted. It's only quoted in his name in one or two places. The rest of the time it's anonymous, but we know it's clear that it's him. Anyways, he interprets it as follows. Yafet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz. It says, when you have two clauses, you have A and you have B. And it's A is with B. B is the major clause, and A is the minor clause. So therefore, he says, if you really, 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 so for example, he quotes, he bases this on another usage in the Talmud, where the Talmud in both Tractate Yoma, which is what the Daf Yomi people are learning now, and also Masechet Kritot, which is towards the end, Kodshim, says as follows. It quotes Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the father of the author of our Mishnah. It says, Yom Kippur mechaper im hatshuva, that Yom Kippur provides, going through Yom Kippur and fasting and so on, will provide atonement. Im hatshuva, if you repent, if you go through the motions, it's not worth it. You require the commitment of repentance in order for Yom Kippur to work. But obviously, therefore, says Rabbeinu Tam, the most important thing is you should repent. You should do the kind of self introspection that's required, and then comes Yom Kippur. You'll go through the whole fast and everything else and confession. Then you'll be converted. You'll be forgiven. But what? The B tshuva is the major part of the equation, or not equation of the relationship. So says Rabbeinu Tam, the way that the Mishnah is written, Yafet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz. It would appear that it's more important to make a living, to first set yourself up so you can sustain yourself and your family, and then go and study, but only in that order. And he says explicitly, Derech Eretz means pragmatia, which means business. So Rabbi Tam Sofer even was in other words in the hierarchy, first set yourself up to be able to make yourself sustainable in this world, and then said devote yourself to study, but only within that framework. He sort of takes a step back. He says that's what the words themselves would indicate. That's what the words themselves would indicate. But then Rabban Gamliel, the son of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, says, Shigiyat shnehem mashkachat avon. If the two of them are together, then you won't sin. Because you won't sin by abandoning the Torah, and you won't sin by virtue of the fact that if you don't make a living, you'll end up falling into crime or all kinds of yes, Harold. You'll call it, you'll do all kinds of horrible things. That's a Mishnah and Kiddushin like that. In any event, so he says, you need both. So you got to balance your time. Interesting, Maimonides, when he describes how you should organize your time, he says, even though you should not study Torah without working, and never take money for learning, he said, nevertheless, if you have a 12-hour day, then 3 hours should be for working and 9 hours should be for study. Okay. Maybe in 12, if you're a money lender and you can get away with, or a pawnbroker, maybe you can get away with opening your store for 3 hours. Most people can't do that today. In any event, this was a very shocking statement because he's saying he said you might have thought that making a living is more important than Talmud Torah. And he comes up with it's 50-50. That's the way he understands the Mishnah. I'm not saying that's the only way I understand the Mishnah. Then the world exploded. His nephew, Rabbi Yitzchak of Dampierre, who was more pietistically inclined, said, what are you talking about? A Torah is more important than anything else, and so on and so forth. So he drays around and has a different way of looking at the Mishnah. But my point is that Rabbi Natan here reflects the practice in among Ashkenazim until the 15th to 14th century, where rabbis didn't take money. They were business people, they were merchants, they did all kinds of stuff. Rashi was not a vintner, but let's leave that alone. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik suggested he might have been an egg salesman. In any event, but that was the point. Rabbis don't take money for Torah. That's something that's outside of, that's something you do, maybe more important, but it's, or as important, but they... You do it. You don't take a dime for that. That begins to shift, and so does a lot of the screaming and yelling about Maimonides' opposition to taking salary, and demanding that people make a living on the outside of their study time. That begins to shift in the 14th century, at least in Ashkenaz, in the wake of expulsions and unending persecutions, and then I don't want to call it a Shoah, but I have to tell you what the Jews went through during the Black Death was as bad as possibly get. It was even worse than the Crusades. The entire rabbinic elite was wiped out. When you read the memorial books from 1348-49, it's always a chaver and harav and harav and harav and a chaver. It was incredible. And it was really one of the miracles of Jewish history that Ashkenazic Jewry was able to reconstitute itself in a process that that's one of the fields that I study. And in order to be able to try to get themselves back on track, two things happened. First of all, the idea of a professional rabbinate that the community should pay the rabbi, get somebody in there to do the job, began to be more and more acceptable. And number two, you begin to have the first academization of the act of ordination. In other words, up until the 14th century, there was no such thing. I mean, the formal smicha that according to tradition went back to Moses, that ended in 425, maybe in the 11th century, but certainly was long gone by the 1300s. And generally, if you want, for a person to become a rabbi, to serve as a scholar and to decide questions of Jewish law, you go and study with a teacher, a bunch of teachers, and when you were ready, the teacher would say, "Fine, you've as far as I'm concerned, you're allowed to pass mishailas, you're allowed to answer questions," and the guy would go out into the world, and if anybody wanted to know, he'd ask his teacher. 14th century, there were a lot of people. Who were passing themselves off as rabbis because there was a vacuum. And it's a long story, but a rabbi in Vienna, well, later was in Vienna, Meir ben Baruch HaLevi, tried to establish some kind of standardization to introduce quality control among rabbis. And that's how these pieces of paper called smicha, which are really hatarat Torah, it's a diploma of sorts, can be started to be used. And then you get to call rabbi, and you get to call morenu, and in fact, at that point, like a couple of generations later, they start complaining that more people want the title. They're not really learned. Rabbi Yisrael Isserlein writes, "Nitmatu halomdi hitrabuha." What do you say? Hitrabuha ha musmachim or nismachim v'nitmatu halomdim. But the people know how to learn, or really are scholars. They're less because everyone wants to get an aliyah, yamod haraf. Anyways, it's in that context that you needed to fill positions that you begin to get money for, that you get these salaries become the norm. And even then, there was a very serious hesitation about it. I mean, it took a long time for the idea that you pay a rabbi that to get away from our Mishnah. It took a long time for that to take hold. For example, the early rabbis who helped to reconstitute Ashkenazic Jewry after the Black Plague, whose name was Rabbi Yaakov Halevi, Maharil is by his acronym, he was a professional shadchan. People started taking money for what's called hachnosa geld in the rabbinate, and for doing weddings and for organizing divorces and whatever case might be, but straight salary, no. So this sort of like tension still exists. Although the truth of the matter is that today, for reasons that I have yet to totally figure out, and it's a little bit out of my area of expertise, it's sort of assumed that you can take money as a kollel guy, and you can take money as a rabbi, and you can take money for this and take money for that. I still think that taking money for rabbinate, as rabbis, Okay. Anyways, let's go on. And anyways, that is this tension about and the problems that are involved in taking money for Torah. The dangers of Maimonides listed, and what I told Dr. Lambert at the time, and I'm comparing myself to Maimonides, of course. I think it's really still very, 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 very true and very, very apt. I'd like to close in light of the last night's unfortunate display of lack of comportment and proper comportment in the Knesset. I'd like to share with you an insight of famous insight of Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, which is directly related to this Mishnah. Yafet Talmud Torah in Derech Eretz. Talmud Torah only works with Derech Eretz. If Derech Eretz means proper etiquette and behavior, okay, or as another famous rabbinic statement goes, Derech Eretz Kadma La Torah, that the one's acting like a mensch comes before Matan Torah. A beautiful statement of this and something for everybody should consider. Is found in Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the last Rosh Hashiva of Elojin, in the beginning of his commentary on the Bible, on the Chumash, in the introduction to Genesis. He says, I understand. He says, if you look at the blessing of Bilam, which we'll read in 2 weeks, he, according to the rabbis, expressed tremendous admiration for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, for the patriarchs. So says substantive. What was it about the patriarchs that excited the admiration of Bilam? And the Netziv says, because the patriarchs, even though they didn't have the Torah wasn't given until Moses, they were able to live in the world. They had to deal with the Philistines, and they had to live with the Hittites, and they had to deal with this one and with that one and the other one, and they knew how to act like people. And if you don't know how to act like a person, your Torah really isn't worth much. If you don't know how to be a mensch, then what good is your Torah? And in fact, he said apropos of Prime Minister Bennett's remarks yesterday, he says, you know, in the first temple period, we know why the temple was destroyed. They were worshiping idols, and they were murdering people, and they were all kinds of, and they were involved in orgiastic rites for all kinds of different gods, and from a moral point of view, you know, they really didn't, never mind, there was no social justice, never mind, you know, so he says, I can understand that. He said, But what about, by chaining, I thought they were all rabbis and scholars, and they're all fighting about how to do mitzvahs right, and so on and so forth. So says the Netziv, yeah, that's the problem. They had all this Torah, but they didn't know how to act like people. They didn't act like human beings. They didn't act like men, as my mother would say. On the contrary, they were busy beating each other up with who's more religious than the next one, and who has more chumras, and who is more this, and who is more that. They're literally beating each other up with their frumkeit. That, says the Netziv, God doesn't tolerate. That is a morally bankrupt society. He says, Yafet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz, that Torah is only good when it comes with Derech Eretz. She Giyat Shnehem Ashkachat Avon, because if you really master and if you master both and you integrate the two, you won't sin. Because at the end of the day, the Torah teaches Derech Eretz, or should, and Derech Eretz should infuse and create a personality, which is a real Torah personality. Oh, okay, we've gone over time a little bit. As usual, this will be posted on my YouTube channel and on Instagram and all kinds of other places. You're welcome to follow on Facebook at Jeffrey Wolf, and on Instagram and wherever else. And certainly tune back and follow all of the wonderful shiurim that are offered on Tel Aviv International Synagogue. And we will see you next week. Have a great week, and be well.